called my parents, but she also had a letter from me that I smuggled out of the prison to her. She still has the letter, by the way. She has 5 letters that I got to her. I wasn't the only one. I was just the only one who came home. And most Americans don't think any POW doesn't come out as well. So many people pressuring the government.
I was just trying to get hold of Dave because there's something wrong with this boy.
Well, that was strange.
I know, but hi, Dave, could you come take a look at this boy? There's something really strange going on. I can't use this one at all.
The other prisoners that came out alive came out in 73. With some of the prisoners from Vietnam, but no one ever announced that they were prisoners in Laos. I've done considerable research, and I remember the names of some of these people.
I'm going to have to find it in the voice. There's something not right here, and I'm not sure what it is. Yeah, first of all, I don't hear anything on my earphones. I'm not sure why. And then, if I have this thing on, it's fall, even when it's really pushing me. Okay, what's it doing? Then nothing.
There's no power on this thing.
Yeah. I didn't want to be tracked. I needed tracking where I live. In my home where I live.
Yeah.
I had too many problems with that. I drove all the way here from a great place. Newsletter has the social security number, which can protect against missing an action of figures in most of the prisons in the time of the social security number. And I had heard the name before, and I thought it was a good one. And I could get
gonna see that.
You're on that thing.
Oh, you're Rosemary, you're gonna have to be quiet because we're ready to go.
Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us in studio here with us Rosemary Conway, who is the only woman, POW, who ever was repatriated from Southeast Asia. And actually, she was repatriated actually from Laos. Wasn't it in Laos that you were? Go ahead, then. You just speak right in the microphone there. Let's see if we can find. Oh, there we are. Go ahead. Yes, we were in Laos?
Yes, that's correct.
All right, fine. So what year was this, and what were you doing over in Laos? Most people aren't over in Laos in a time of war or a time of the turmoil that was there going on there in 74 and 75.
I had been in Vietnam previously, and I was in Laos in 1974 and 1975, and I was an educational and training consultant.
All right.
And among other things, I worked very closely with the Royal Lao Air Force.
All right, fine. So then what were you doing with the Royal Lao Air Force?
Well, I was a training consultant, and some of the times I flew with the Royal Lao Air Force.
All right, fine. So were you working for our military, for the Army?
I was a civilian.
All right.
Under the umbrella of the Department of Defense, for one of the agencies for the Department of Defense, under the Department of Defense.
Well, then how did you happen to get captured by the Laotian government? You were captured by the Viet Cong or what?
No, I was captured by the Pathet Lao.
By the Pathet Lao.
And being that all of the Royal Lao Air Force planes belonged to the CIA and all of the personnel in the Lao Air Force worked for our government, it was very important to our government to get the aircraft out. Even though a lot of more older aircraft, there were a very large number of military still based in Thailand, and three of the bases we leased from the Thai government were right along the Lao border, Udorn being the furthest north, and then Nakhon Phnom, and then further south, the base called Uban Air Base. And we had a large number of personnel there. And since there had been a problem with that Mayaguez incident, in which one of our aircraft was shot, an Air Force plane was shot down, we didn't want any problems. And the communist in Laos, the Pathet Lao, didn't have an Air Force. But we were concerned that about the North Vietnamese Air Force getting a hold of them, since when the peace agreement was signed in Vietnam, although Mr. Kissinger got the peace prize, the peace agreement was never signed. Agreements were never signed for Laos or Cambodia.
All right, fine. So basically then, our government wanted to get all the aircraft that we had in Laos out.
Right.
And did we have people stationed in Laos or in Cambodia? Certainly we were told that we weren't supposed to have any people there. Did we?
Oh, yes.
All right. So, but they were all civilians. They were not military.
Oh, wrong. The Ravens were stationed in Laos.
Now, what were the Ravens?
The Ravens were a group of Air Force pilots who flew in the early part of the war, flew O-1s, the push-pull airplanes made by Cessna. And later on, starting in 1970, they flew O-2s. They were spotter planes, usually call sign Sandy. Were the forward air controllers.
All right, so
what they called the airstrikes in over Laos, because when the peace agreement was signed for Vietnam, it hadn't been signed for Laos or Cambodia, so we were still flying missions over Cambodia and Laos.
I see. Well, did we have troops stationed in Cambodia at all? We weren't supposed to.
I've met people who were brought into Cambodia.
All right. In other words, they were there even though the American people were told that they weren't there, that we had troops in that area. Now, let's get a little bit into your own experience. You were on some sort of a mission. How did it happen that you were captured by the Path of Lao?
Well, when I first went to Laos, I was told to become a legal resident of Laos, and some of our government people helped me get that expedited. It took about 45 minutes for me to become a legal resident.
All right, so you were a legal resident, and you were actually more in education then?
Well, I was a legal resident, and they asked me what my occupation was, and I said educational consultant. They never asked anything further.
Now, who were you educating?
Well, I spent a little time at a school, at the international school in Vientiane, but I spent a good amount of time, more time with the military.
All right, fine. So we won't go into that anymore.
Well, I had a multiple exit reentry visa, which I could go back, and because I was a legal resident, I could go back and forth to Cambodia, Laos, even North Vietnam, and multiple places, so I could cross at any of the river crossings, which did make it very easy for me to make multiple trips in to get the airplanes out and to go to the bases and ask the pilots.
That was what you were really doing, was helping to get the planes out.
At the time, yes. I went. There was a base in Savannakhet, a base at Long Chin, that was the CIA headquarters, actually, and there was a base in Pak Sei and Luang Prabang.
All right, so basically, you were going in and out of Laos and in adjacent countries. Now, how was it that you happened to get caught?
Well, I was on the ground. This was my last trip to get the pilots getting the aircraft out, and I was on the ground. I was in a restaurant prior to leaving, and someone told me someone's waiting for me outside the restaurant, and they wanted to talk to me, which was common. It happened a lot because I speak Lao.
Where were you at this time?
I was in Vientiane.
What was Vientiane?
That was the administrative capital of Laos.
That was, you were in Laos in the administrative capital.
Right.
You go outside and you're arrested?
No, I wasn't arrested. I was never arrested. Two men in civilian clothes, in fact, Western type gear, each held a gun to each side of me and told me not to open my mouth or they'd shoot me immediately.
All right, fine. So
and being the border was already closed, I did. They walked me a couple blocks away to a car that they had apparently taken when the communists had surrounded, the communists had already surrounded the embassy.
So now, of course, you are a prisoner of the of this communist group. So what happened to you at that time?
Okay, then they brought me to the Path at Lao headquarters for 10 days. Fortunately, during the time I was held in the major's office, an Australian reporter for Associated Press took a picture that that was taken with a long lens camera through the darkened windows of a Mercedes, and instead of giving it to the American government, who probably would have classified it, he put it on the wire service.
Now, basically what you were suggesting then is that had it been given to the American government, you never would have gotten out. In other words, we know that our government abandoned an awful lot of our boys. Isn't that true?
Oh, absolutely.
And they've lied to the American people about it ever since?
Absolutely.
All right. Now, Rosemary Conway is the only woman who ever got back, only prisoner of war, whoever was repatriated from Southeast Asia. If you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to call us, Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And basically, we're talking about her experiences. So how long were you actually held by the communists there?
I was held less than 3 months.
All right, fine. Yeah. Now, how was it then that you were repatriated? This was about 1975.
That's
correct. The American troops were pretty well out of Vietnam at that time?
Oh, yes. Cambodia was the first country to fall, and then Vietnam was second.
All right, fine.
And
so,
Laos was last.
Had the Laos actually fallen at the time you were there, you were released?
I was captured on June 4th. The border was closed and sealed. The communists took over the borders of Laos on June 1st.
All right. Now, then, how was it that you were released? What pressure was brought to bear to get the communists to release you when they did not release so many of the other prisoners who were there?
Well, I don't think there was a lot of pressure brought to bear until I was able to smuggle quite a few letters out. I'm from Chicago, and I actually smuggled a letter to Mayor Daley, which he received and acted upon immediately. I had friends in the Arizona National Guard in Tucson, and I got a letter to them. I got many, many letters smuggled out.
Well, you were very fortunate then to be able to get them out. Did the guards help you?
No, the guards never helped me. When the coalition government came into effect in Laos in March of 74, the Border Patrol Police were a joint faction of Pathet Lao and Royal Lao, and I lived right on the border. My house was right on the border, and I befriended both the Pathet Lao and the Royal Law, especially since I would be making a lot of border crossings. And I taught the Pathet Lao, these young guys at the border, how to play badminton and volleyball. And they were my visitors when I was in the prison.
All right, fine. So they helped you get the letters out.
They did.
And you think it was just because there was so much information on the fact that you were alive and well you were able to get out, whereas most of the boys, of course, that we abandoned, the government kept saying, everybody's home, everybody's home. And they knew it wasn't true. Henry Kissinger knew it wasn't true. Richard Nixon knew it wasn't true, and he lied to the American people. Because, of course, what really had happened, and I'm sure you're well aware of this, is that Henry Kissinger, during the negotiations in Paris, had promised that we would give $3 or $4 billion to Vietnam, to North Vietnam, to compensate them for the damage done to their country during the war. And then, of course, he decided he wouldn't do it, or Congress wouldn't put up the money. So how could they tell the American people that we were going to sacrifice probably well over 1,000 American soldiers rather than put out $1 billion, a couple of billion dollars? So they simply lied about it. And Henry Kissinger has always lied. He lied about that. He's lied about everything. And, of course, what a terrible tragedy. But not only that, what a tragedy that Richard Nixon went along with it. And I know Richard Nixon told a friend of yours, Captain Red McDaniels, when Nixon was very, very ill, and McDaniels went to see him. And Nixon said, well, I always intended to go back to get them, but after all, after Watergate, I couldn't do anything. But all he had to do was just come forward and say what had really happened, and he never had the courage to do that. And he let those boys rot in there, and there's evidence that some of them are still there.
Absolutely.
Right. And the American government, of course, can't come forward and admit that they've lied. So whether it be the Republicans or the Democrats who control Washington, D.C., it's cover up, cover up, cover up. Have you run into this as you've analyzed this? And I know you are still actively working to try to get those boys out.
Well, yes. And I don't forget the women. There were women prisoners. And
how many women were there, do you think?
I don't know, but I think I heard there were, like, between the missing and the prisoners, something in around 30. But one name I remember was Eleanor Vietti. Eleanor Vietti was a medical doctor who worked at the leprosarium in Vietnam and got captured in Vietnam and brought into Vietnam, into Laos from Vietnam. And she was held at Sam Nua Vieng Sai. And being she was a doctor, what I heard through the communists, they were short on doctors when so many people fled the country. So that's one of the reasons they wanted to keep her.
All right. Well, of course, the great tragedy is that they did keep people that they could really utilize. I know that Bobby Garwood they liked, because Bobby Garwood could fix almost anything. He was very, very clever. He could fix motors. And that, of course, was the talent that he used. And eventually, he did come back. And, of course, the government then had to discredit him when he came back. They had to destroy his character. They had to say he defected to the other side. Because if they'd not said that, people would have listened to him as he told about all the other prisoners who were there. But you know the thing that bothers me most, Rosemary, is most Americans really don't care about the boys we abandon. Oh, they may feel a little bit bad, but they don't understand. We send young men to other countries to fight and bleed and die, and of course they are abandoned.
Well, loyalty should be a two-way street.
It certainly should be. All right, well, let's get into some of the other details. Well, anyway, then eventually what happened as far as your being released? Was any money paid, or why did the communists decide to release you?
I didn't just write letters to the United States. I wrote a letter in Laos, some letters in Laos to the Laos Minister of Foreign Affairs. And I had met him one time previously, and I wrote a letter to him. It turned out he was in China at the time. But 3 days before I got released, the acting Minister of Foreign Affairs came in behalf of Pumi Vongvichit, who was in China having some medical care done, and he came and actually met with me. And while I was in prison earlier, the communists told me they wanted $34 million, and were asking for $4 million for my release. And I said, "Where'd you come up?" I said, "They wouldn't pay that much for the president, and especially that president." I didn't say that to them, but anyway, they said, "Well, that's how much aid we got before Laos fell. That's what was our annual aid the year before." And I said, "There's no way they'll pay that kind of money. You're going to have to be much more reasonable." Well, it turned out $1.2 million was paid by the CIA for my release.
All right. So you actually were sort of more or less ransomed out, but $1.2 million.
Yes. I saw the CIA document myself.
Well, now, were some of the other prisoners really ransomed out as well?
I don't know of any that were, but the French had set the precedent. They paid for their prisoners. And so this is why the communists in Southeast Asia expected that we would pay for our prisoners, too. No. But it's not in our charter to do that.
Well, I think that the listeners probably don't remember. Of course, the French had to surrender at Dien Bien Phu. And a large number of French prisoners and French Foreign Legion prisoners were taken by the Viet Cong. And they were actually held and gradually ransomed out. But the French government had the integrity eventually to ransom out most, if not all, of those prisoners, although some of them remained in prison for 20 or more years. Our government decided we wouldn't try to ransom our men out. And, of course, when we could have certainly said to the North Vietnamese, "Well, we'll give you recognition and foreign aid, and allow you to sell your goods in our country and bring industry in there if you give our men back." By that time, the leaders of both political parties had decided it would be far, far easier simply to abandon the men rather than to admit that it had all been a lie.
Well, one thing I should mention in relation to this, although we had no diplomatic relations with Vietnam or Cambodia, we never stopped having diplomatic relations with Laos, but most Americans were not aware of that, especially the families of the missing in action. And a number of them told me, they were told at a group meeting by someone from the State Department, whose name I don't recall at the moment, that we had no more diplomatic relations with Laos. Our ambassador was withdrawn, Ambassador Whitehouse was withdrawn for some meetings back in Washington because he was going to replace the ambassador in Unger in Thailand. But we had a charge, the affairs, Christian Chapman.
All right,
and he did nothing. He was under house arrest in his own house and didn't even, and according to the people at the embassy when I got released, they said he didn't even tell the people back in Washington, D.C. that he was under house arrest.
All right. Now, as far as the other prisoners, did some of the other prisoners actually ransomed out of Laos?
None that I know about.
So the rest of them,
there were Chuck Klusman and Dieter Dengler escaped way in the early part of the war. And then Ernie Brace and Ted, I'm trying to think his name now. Anyway, there were some other prisoners that came back from came out from Laos when they released the prisoners from Vietnam in 73. Only it, there was nothing made of it in the press that they had been prisoners in Laos.
Well, I think that the...
Just a small handful.
The American people don't understand that we had a number of pilots, American pilots, that were downed in Laos. And, of course, they were never brought back. What you heard was the government saying over and over again why all of the prisoners are back. And, of course, they knew very well, that there were a lot of prisoners. Not one prisoner that I know of besides you ever came back from Laos. In other words, was ever brought back or released.
But they knew prisoners were there. Our government knew for sure. And I have a lieutenant colonel.
Wait a minute. We're going to have to go to a break here. We'll be back in just a moment here with Rosemary Conway. We'll welcome your calls as soon as we get back from this break. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and of course, this is the time that we reintroduce again our special guest this evening, who's in studio with me, Rosemary Conway. And she was a prisoner of war in Laos in that period, 1974, 1975. And of course, she was able to get out. And then, of course, you actually continued to go back to Southeast Asia. Were you in Thailand, or did you make other trips over there after you escaped, after you were released?
Yes, I did. I was over there for 4 years, as a matter of fact.
All right, fine. So, here's an area of the world that's just sort of struggling. It's been involved in a 20-year war. Actually, they were at war almost all constantly from 1945, from the end of the Second World War, up until, of course, the American evacuation of Saigon. What was that, 1974?
No, it was
1975.
April of 75.
Okay, fine. And, what a terrible, terrible tragedy. Because, you see, if you've ever read the rules of engagement for Vietnam, you realize that our boys never went there to win. They were never allowed to win. We have the rules of engagement here at Radio Liberty. They were published in the Congressional Record. And when you realize that all sorts of barriers were put on, it's not surprising that Robert McNamara was to say, back in 1965, I knew our boys couldn't win. Well, then if he knew they couldn't win, why couldn't they win? I mean, here the great, you saw what happened in Baghdad recently. We could have done the same thing over there. I was personally told by the American ambassador to Vietnam. His name was William H. Sullivan, and I interviewed him in 1980 at Columbia University. And he told me, I never understood why we didn't win. We could have won at any time. I actually talked to General Lewis Walt, a four-star Marine general who was assistant commandant of Marines, and he told me we could have won at any time in 2 months. We were never allowed to win. So our boys were never there to win. It was simply a wonderful distraction because it was during that 10-year period that America changed forever. It was during that period that they changed the immigration laws to convert America from a Christian or Judeo-Christian nation into a multicultural nation. It was during those years they took God and prayer out of our schools. It was during those years that they brought the Great Society programs into America to bring about socialism and create the mess in health care that we have today. It was during those years that they found that a woman had a right to kill her baby in her womb if she wanted to. There were all sorts of things and dramatic changes in the morality. Of course, it was during those years that we began to implement Alfred Kinsey's programs of immorality, which, of course, had such a terrible price today as more and more of our young people carry venereal diseases. But all of this really goes back to the period of Vietnam and, of course, the influx of drugs at that time, much of it associated with the CIA. Did you ever run into the CIA and drugs at all when you were there, Rosemary?
As a matter of fact, I did run into drugs. When I was teaching at the American school, I had been there a couple of months before I went in the back to the school for the blind, and everyone that worked in there was blind. When I went in there, what I noticed on a wall that was about 10 feet wide were shelves and shelves full of 2 kilo bags, roughly 2 kilo bags of heroin. But it was unusual. They had no brand name. Most people that had heroin were proud of their brand name, just like most American companies are. And so I I opened one of the bags, took a little plastic bag that they used to pull, the kind they used to pour the Pepsi in over there. And
we'll be
right
back here in just a moment. All right, fine. You were Rosemary's telling us that when she was in Laos, why, of course, she actually worked in a school for the blind, and, of course, that she noticed that there were bags of heroin there now, and so she noticed there were no markings on these, and she took some of the heroin out. Go ahead, Mary.
Okay, I didn't work in the school for blind. It was another building on the campus,
fine.
And so what I did is I took one of those little bags that they pour the Pepsi and put a, for the veterans over there, they know they put a rubber band and a straw on it. And I took one of those bags and I took some of the powder out, put it in there, and took a taxi over to the National Police Building. And I went up to the fourth floor, that National Police Building's like our FBI, went right up to the fourth floor where our USAID Public Safety office was. It said USAID Public Safety. I went in there and dealt with the very same man who got me my resident visa in 45 minutes. And I said to him, I said, what does this look like to you? And he says, number 4, heroin. And at that time, he brought me over to the Drug Enforcement Administration. We went in his car and went over to the Drug Enforcement Administration.
There was a Drug Enforcement Administration right there in the...
Not in the embassy, building, but in the
United... Laos Capitol. So then, but what happened? Was this CIA heroin? Whose heroin was it?
No, I never knew who. There was a director of the school who was Australian, so I didn't know who the heroin belonged to. I never asked, but being I was the whole thing I was told to do was apply at this school, which covered everything else I was doing. I was concerned about no longer having a cover, so when I went into the fellow at the DEA, who later went to work in Detroit, he had a file on the owner, the director, supposed owner of the school, who I found out later wasn't really the owner. Anyway, they had 10 names, and they had a great big file, and I could see the secret stamps on all the pages.
Are you suggesting that this school was a cover for some covert operation that was operating over there?
I found out later it was.
All right, and of course, this covert operation that you're speaking of somehow was tied into drugs. Is this what you're suggesting?
Well, not the part I was involved in, but...
the rest of it, though. If they got bags of heroin all along the walls,
well,
obviously, it's a pretty big operation.
Well, I asked the man from the United States Agency of International Development Public Safety, I said, what's the value of heroin? And he said, well, it's $1,000 a kilo in Laos. In Bangkok, that same kilo would be worth... $1,600, and in New York City, $400,000 before it was uncut.
All right, fine. So basically, there was a major operation there. The DEA knew about it and wasn't going to do anything.
The DEA was the DEA was actually didn't work in conjunction with the Lao government. Our USAID Public Safety Office had when you went inside that when I went inside it was said narcotics.
Just slow down,
okay.
Just a little bit.
Okay.
But the DEA knew about this operation and didn't do anything about it.
Well, I don't know what they did
But you noticed that they knew
nothing.
All about it, and they had big secret stamps all on the file there.
Yes.
So
they knew there was something going on, and I didn't ask them any questions. They put me on contract for $10,000.
I'm sorry, they put you on contract.
Contract, because I had in case the school got raided, they put me on contract to protect me.
What is contract?
I worked. I gave them information for they wanted me to find out about more about the situation at the school, and they also wanted me to spend most of my extra time with it when I had it to find out by a man by the name of Michelle Teodos, who owned the Inter Hotel right by the border. But he also was the manager of the Langsang Hotel, where I'm saying this for a reason.
Right.
He was the manager of the Langsang Hotel. This is where the families of the missing in action who came to Laos to find out about their family members stayed. I found out in my investigation that his wife was a Vietnamese communist who was negotiating to sell American prisoners of war captured in Laos to the Vietnamese communists.
I see. So rather than sell them to the Americans, they were going to sell them to the communists. Of course, they were a very good commodity. Unfortunately, our government wouldn't pay anything for them and, of course, abandoned them. Well, our telephone number is 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And, of course, Rosemary has been involved in this for many years and certainly feels very deeply about the others. She was fortunate to get out. The others really didn't get out. So this is something we can never forget, is that we abandoned our boys in the First World War, in the Second World War, in Korea, Vietnam. Let's hope that it never happens again. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our special guest today is Rosemary Conway, and we're talking to her about her experiences when she was a prisoner of war in Laos. And, of course, she was able to get out. Fortunately, she was ransomed by our government because, obviously, she was able to have enough public attention drawn to her plight. The great tragedy is the other men who were left behind, and women as well, that Rosemary's talked about. The family organizations here in the United States have been infiltrated by our own government and effectively neutralized. And I've had people from so many of these organizations on. And what the families are told, oh, don't make a fuss about this. Don't go to the media. Don't talk about it. Because if you do, why, you're going to endanger the lives of your loved ones. We're working on something. Just wait another month or 3 months or year or 5 years or 10 years. Or, you know, of course, time and time again, our families are told, well, we found the remains of your loved ones. And, of course, they're really not. I mean, they've time and time again, they've come up with false remains, and they knew there were false remains. And yet, of course, anything to keep the American people from understanding the treachery and deceit that has been practiced for so many years. In fact, there was a colonel who was in charge of this whole operation for the Defense Intelligence Agency. And when he realized that he was there simply to cover for this, he eventually wrote a resignation. And I've heard the story. He put that resignation on the door of his office in the Pentagon and stabbed it there with a knife and resigned his commission. He could not put up with the betrayal of so many fighting men, brave and courageous young men. And that seems to be the story over and over again, because we've allowed the reins of government to be taken over by people who have a different agenda, who look at the world differently, who are dedicated to this New World Order and New World Religion. Well, Rosemary, are you associated with any of the POW groups today?
No, I'm not, but a lot of the families track me down. I knew about the names of a lot of the POWs for two reasons. Number one, I was in the room with the list for 10 days. I never got to get my hands on it, but when they moved prisoners, they didn't know I could speak Lao, number one, at that time. And the communists that took me prisons were from Sinquan province. They weren't for any of them that had been around Vientiane. And they read the names of prisoners they were transferring. And the guards that were officers who could speak English, the ones that were with me at the time of when I was at the Pathet Lao headquarters. I heard them talking about the prisoners, and they didn't know my background at all. And I asked them questions, and they were told me about some of the prisoners. And they told me about the prisoners of Chapon, which is near the Vietnamese border. And they told me they had the crew of a C-123, and they had some from an AC. They said the one was with the gun, so I would assume they were probably talking about Spectre gunship. And they had one F-105 pilot.
They had one
F-105. That's the Thunder Chief, known as the Thud.
Uh-huh.
They flew lots of missions in Laos.
Okay, fine.
In fact, they were the ones that bombed Site 85 that Mr. Sullivan should have been able to tell you about, because Site 85, Pupiti Mountain, whereas where we had the big radar site, was the highest point there to watch the Hanoi area. And when that fell in, I believe it was March of 68, that's when everything went downhill in the war. In fact, Mr. Sullivan doesn't have a very great track record.
He was the ambassador in Laos when things went downhill.
He was the ambassador in Iran when it went downhill. He was the ambassador in the Philippines when Marcos got removed. So he's been in some very troublesome situations as ambassador.
Well, he was a very, very close friend of David Rockefeller's. He told me that. And, of course, he was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. On the other hand, I thought he was, at least most of what he said to me, was a really very, very revealing of the background of the hostage situation over there in Iraq, and certainly what had happened in... But he was very, very close to Kissinger. And, of course, being close to Kissinger, many times you have to compromise your principles. So, but under any circumstances, we lost... Do we have any idea how many men we abandoned in Laos, men and women?
One thing I heard was about... When I did my debriefing about the military prisoners in Laos, I only debriefed with the DIA about the military prisoners and that. And there were quite a few. It was a large list. I mean,
are we talking about hundreds or thousands? Because, of course, we had not only the military, we also had many, many civilians working for our government who were there.
I know the State Department asked me about a guy by the name of Dean. And I know of names, I was asked by the communists of names that weren't on the list. That's how I got my nose broken, because they asked me about two guys by the name of Emerson and Huxley, and I told them I knew nothing about it. They wouldn't believe me, and they hit me across the nose with an AK-47, which broke my nose, which the government never even paid to fix.
All right. Well, the thing is that, do we have any idea how many?
Several hundreds. I heard a figure of 384 at five locations.
All right, fine. Now, were these all military, or were these military and civilians?
Those, I believe, were military prisoners. And I also knew the name of the man, the Lao man, who gave the list of American POWs to the American government.
All right,
His name was General Kamu Busarath. He was a very close friend of mine.
All right.
I remember Ross Perot talking about on TV how he went over to Laos in, I believe, 72, and they were supposed to have a meeting to give the list over, and he said they had the meeting and they never gave the list over. Well, I called him to tell him that they did give the list over, and I knew who gave it over to them, and he actually had that. I brought that man to see him.
I'm sorry. Ross Perot went to Laos.
Yes, he did.
To get the list. And you...
Well, he never got the list.
He never got the list.
Our government didn't include... the government officials at the embassy just didn't include Ross Perot in the meeting. They lied to him.
All right.
He's the only one...
Go slow.
He's the only person who ever, other than... that negotiated for American prisoners. And our government never negotiated for American prisoners before in Laos, even though the embassy's been remained open all this time.
All right, so... Then,
and they never signed the peace agreement.
Now, what did Ross Perot hope to do at that time?
Well, this was by the time... He was trying to help the prisoners of war. I remember one time he was trying to give Thanksgiving dinner to the POWs in Vietnam, and he had to go through Laos to try to do that.
All right, now, of course, what years was this?
I believe he went over there in 1972.
Well, now, this was before the fall, then, of Vietnam.
That's right.
All right. And we know that, of course, he talked a lot about that. In fact, he even funded some of the efforts, the incursions into Vietnam. Did you ever know Colonel Bo Greit?
Oh, very well. Yes, right. He's a good friend of mine.
Colonel Greit, apparently, was actually commissioned by President Reagan, my understanding.
He worked for ISA, ISA.
Right. But he actually gave up his commission in the special forces and went over there, and supposedly there was money funneled to Ross Perot for those incursions.
I never heard anything about Ross Perot, but money was funneled over there. But the reason that venture wasn't successful is because our own Voice of America broadcast in Laos our people that were there and exactly where they were. And one of the men got caught, and they did get him back.
Well, the story basically that Bo Greit told me, Colonel Greit told me, is exactly what Rosemary is saying. That, I mean, they're going in on this clandestine operation to try to rescue the POWs. And, of course, Special Forces people are very well trained. They're very efficient, as we've seen over in the Iraq War recently. And so they're sneaking through the jungle, And suddenly they somehow tune into the Voice of America, and Voice of America is telling the communists exactly where they are and who's involved. Now, you couldn't do something like that, that stupid, unintentionally. And, of course, as with any effort to get our boys back from Vietnam, it's very obvious that our boys were betrayed, and Colonel Greitz was betrayed. And as you say, he told me they almost lost the entire group that he was with because information had been given by somebody in Washington, D.C. to the Voice of America that was just using our facilities to tell the communists exactly where this rescue team was. And this is sort of the story that's gone on over and over again, isn't it?
It's not just, it's, to me, it wasn't a story. Personal friends of mine, Lao and Thai, told me they heard the broadcast. At one time, I even had a transcript of the broadcast, and that, among other things, got stolen from my home.
Okay, fine. Well, I think that there are really so many things. Now, since you've come back, you're living in this country now full-time?
Yes.
All right. And, of course, have you had any harassment at all because of your knowledge of what transpired over there?
Tremendous amount. I would go usually try to go to one or two reunions a year, but usually when I would go to a reunion, that's why I didn't go to a reunion I was invited to this year. I would come back and find my place trashed.
Now, in other words, you would go to a reunion of some of the people who came back from Vietnam, some of the POWs?
No, just some of the military that I knew.
All right.
And on a number of occasions, I'd come back and my house was trash, but the only thing that was ever taken were documents, I had 500 documents that the CIA declassified between 77 and 79, some of them that were several pages long, and very few people had those. When Carter came in, he took the power away from the CIA to be involved in anything relating POWs or MIAs. And when they declassified those documents, they handed them over to the Defense Intelligence Agency, who reclassified them. So they were very anxious to get copies for the small number of people that had them. And I know about one day I found that my place was broken into when I lived in Phoenix. I found out four other people around the country that had those documents had their homes broken into also, and the documents removed.
Are you suggesting that the CIA violates the law? And
No. This was not the CIA.
Oh, no.
I have never, ever had the slightest problem with the CIA.
Who was it?
And this was the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency.
I see, okay.
But apparently things are different under President Bush because obviously the CIA played a great part in rescuing the prisoners out of Iraq. And the other thing that I see different between the Vietnam War and this war is President Bush is allowing the military to run the war. That was not the case in Vietnam.
Well,
the State Department had the final say-so on everything.
Right. Well, if you just commented that the CIA was somehow involved in the rescue of the prisoners in Iraq...
That's what they were saying on the news, on TV. They were part of it, part of the rescue.
They were part of the effort.
With the special ops.
I see. Well, of course, the special ops, I think our prisoners have to, our listeners have to understand, are a very, very highly specialized group of armed forces. Apparently, they operate in groups of about 10 to 12 men. They're all professional killers. They're trained to kill by all sorts of means. They're in top-notch physical shape, highly disciplined, and, of course, they can go into an enemy area and operate efficiently behind the lines. And with, of course, access to air cover and excessive firepower, they can operate almost independently anywhere in the world, can't they?
Yes, absolutely.
And, of course, they were actually operating in western Iraq before the war started. There were about 10 of these groups in northern Iraq at the very beginning of the war before they dropped in the paratroopers.
Mm-hmm.
And with those 10 groups, perhaps 100 men, they gave the impression of a great force. In fact, much of the Iraqi army sort of faded away because they thought that there were a lot more American forces there than there really were.
Mm-hmm.
But using laser-guided bombing and laser-guided plane attacks. They were able to focus in on the enemy concentrations. And with this 10 men and air cover, they would just wipe out, entire battalions or even certainly rather large units of the enemy. So this is a whole different warfare that is being fought now using primarily the special forces.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's Bo Greit's group was a diversified group, too. I know one of his men was Scott Weekly, who was a Navy SEAL. So he had they were special ops.
Right.
Not all the special forces are special ops. Out of the Green Berets, only 10% of those become special ops.
Right. All right, fine. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to talk to Rosemary, our telephone number, 464-8295, or out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And it's a fascinating unique opportunity to talk to someone who was a prisoner of war and came back. And, of course, when you stop and think that she was probably one of the only people who came back from Laos, and certainly so many of our prisoners were abandoned there, the fact that the CIA ransomed her out and brought her back here has given her a tremendous insight into what's going on in our society today. Well, you know, what are some of the other things you'd like to share with our listeners tonight, Rosemary?
Oh, let me think. There's a misinformation that a lot of people have about prisoners of war. They think like the hostages, they get humongous amounts of money. I want to make it clear that what POWs get for their imprisonment is $5 a day for inadequate food and housing.
I see. That's what they get when they come back. Huh?
Yes, that's all you get.
All right, fine. Well, of course, the only person who came back after the prisoner exchange in 1975, I guess what they called it, was Bobby Garwood. And, of course, did you ever run into Bobby Garwood's story?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, the man who polygraphed him, who's an expert considered a really expert in polygraph. In fact, he was contracting to polygraph CIA employees, told me that he's the one that arranged for me to meet Bobby Garwood. He said he totally believed me, had polygraphed him a number of times, and totally believed his entire story.
Now, of course, everything was done to discredit Bobby Garwood. If any of our listeners, if you haven't heard the 4-tape set we have, One Man Returned, it's the story of Bobby Garwood. From a number of different points of view, the man, the officer who was supposed to kill him, that was his job, Lieutenant Colonel Tom McKinney, and then interviews with he and Bobby, and then an interview all alone. Probably the only interview I know of that anybody has with Bobby Garwood alone, but he really used his ingenuity to escape. And when it became so obvious and the whole world knew that he was there, why he was nothing our government could do but to bring him back. But he was told by the Viet Cong before he was released, you'll be sorry you were ever released. You'll prefer, you'd feel much more comfortable if you were to die here.
I have a very good friend, Colonel Ted Guy,
right,
who was one of a group of ex-POWs. Ted Guy was captured in Laos and spent part of his imprisonment in Laos, part of it in Vietnam. And he and another group of prisoners, ex-POWs, complained about turncoats that were in the prison in Vietnam with them and the ones that helped the communists. And these were military officers. They tried to get court-martialed, and they spent a lot of effort on it. Red McDaniels is well aware of this. And they were unsuccessful in their efforts against these guys. One of them is became a doctor, was a doctor in Florida. I don't know if he's still there.
Anyway,
what happened is when they had Bobby Garwood's trial, what did our government do but use these same individuals that were, according to other POWs, were turncoats turning against them? They had those particular individuals testify against Bobby Garwood.
I know, and first, one of them is a United States Senator today. Well, all right, let's go back to Ron from Richland, Washington. Hi, Ron, how are you doing? Ron, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay, do you have a question or comment?
Well, comment. I'm just very fascinated by your guest. This is wonderful information.
Well,
and it's and one of the big problems with the United States today is that we have corruption at the top of our government.
Well,
in fact,
unfortunately,
maybe and I think it's about time we rooted it out, and light will destroy a fungus.
Well, that's why I do what I do 5 hours a day and just help me reach as many people as we possibly can. But I agree with you. What we need to do, though, is get the American people really to care and to understand that men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose.
Well, does Rosemary have a book?
Can you hear anything there, Rosemary?
I can't hear the question.
All right, fine. Well, could I suggest that you take the cord on your there? And there's a little delay there. Why don't you adjust that and just see if you can hear anything? Can you hear now?
Yes, I can.
Okay, fine. So I was just adjusting the head. But, of course, Ron wants to know if you have a book or a website or how people can learn more about you.
Oh, I'd love to take it at one of these congressmen's town hall meetings.
Right.
Just be, you know, re-elect so-and-so or something and, you know, a big button on your... the suit coat and be out there with a big smile and be handing out things like this.
All right, fine. Rosemary, what are your thoughts on?
Well, I did appear in 1981 before Congressman Dornan's congressional committee, and when he saw me on Ted Koppel Nightline, he called me. Here he was, ahead of this commission, and he had never heard of me, never knew I had been a POW, and his motivation to be on that committee and be the head of it was because his former roommate, David Herdlicka, was a prisoner of war, his roommate from in flight school when he was in the Air Force. And it was ironic about David Herdlicka because his picture in captivity, great big picture with his name tag in very large letters, was all over the place in Laos.
Right. So he was there, and you knew
he was a prisoner when I was.
All right, fine. Correct.
Yeah. And so was Charles Shelton and Morgan Donahue from the C-123.
I think that the tragedy is, Ron, that because Bob Dornan really did want to get to the bottom of the POW issue, that's one reason the members, the Republicans, did not back him when...
They let him be destroyed.
That's right. Because the leadership of both political parties is trying to cover this up, and they certainly don't like congressmen like Bob Dornan who tries to get the truth out. Anything else you want to cover?
Well, just one thing. One of the gals I work with was from Vietnam, and she was one of the boat people. She came out when she was 12 years old. And since then, she's actually gone back, you know, just to visit. But I think there's somewhat of a different management philosophy, except for the politics and religion. You can more or less do what you want. It's a much freer society than it was, especially economically. At least
right.
That's what she said.
Right.
Would there be possible that you could make contact with some people in the Vietnamese government now, and maybe they would be somewhat receptive to sending these folks back?
Our government does not want them back, and they have been offered to send them back, and my understanding is they've been told under no circumstances do we want those men back. Okay.
Those guys are just
rotten to the core.
Well, I'll tell you,
let's get Rosemary's response to what I said. Rosemary, what's your take on what I just said?
Well, some of the prisoners, of course, were sent to the Soviet bloc countries, and then I don't know what happened to them for sure when the Soviet Union fell. But I've heard that some of them got sent back to Vietnam. But I don't know. My scariest moment as a POW was when the KGB came in with a big thick file on me. And I was terrified about getting sent to the Soviet Union. Fortunately, it never happened.
There's a wonderful book, Rod. It's called Moscow Bound. And you can't get out of print now, but you can probably get it through Amazon.com or one of the used bookstores. Read it, and it'll, of course, break your heart. Now, we know that our good friends in the Soviet Union brought a lot of those people over for experiments. We probably even got some of the records of what it took to break their spirits and souls. Hey, thanks so much for calling.
Yes, sir.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Lee from Arizona. Hi, Lee. How are you doing?
Good. I've got a question for Rosemary.
Okay.
Actually, it's I read a newsletter at my friend's house. It was called POW Strike Force out of Houston, Texas. And it talked about two POWs that were released and put on the Witness Protection Program under the Clinton administration.
You're talking about prisoners that were somehow released, the American
right.
people were never told?
That's my recollection.
All right.
I do remember one of the two names. It was Joy Owens. At first, I thought that was a woman, but it turned out to be a man. That's why I remember the name. But I don't recall the other person's name. I was wondering if Rosemary could corroborate that.
Yes, I can, as a matter of fact. I had heard the name Joy Owens myself, and I thought that was another female POW, and I checked it out through the list and through a journalist that had a journalist check into it, and that was a man who was a pilot. I believe he was flying out of Udor, and I know it was one of the bases in Thailand near the Lao border.
Okay.
And, of course, there have been these rumors for a long time. That, of course, the government could never admit that they'd lie to the people. After all, we're supposed to know that government will always be honest. So I've heard these rumors that at least a certain number of people were ransomed, but, of course, were never allowed to return home and put into witness protection. Do you think there's any truth to that, Rosemary?
Oh, I don't doubt it for a minute.
Uh-huh.
There was a case of that I heard about. It was on Unsolved Mysteries. It was a Marine by the name of Borton, B-O-R-T-O-N, and his family members said they saw him, and they talked to a journalist in California who wrote some stories about it. I don't have the stories, but anyway, Unsolved Mysteries heard about that, and they actually put a program on about this, and that the father of Borton and the sister had both seen him on a couple of occasions.
Okay, anything else, Lee, you want to bring up?
No, that's it. Thank
All you. Right, thank you so much. Well, there are a lot of strange things out there, and the important thing is that we realize that we're involved in a spiritual battle, because behind everything that goes on are these dark forces. You can't understand the treachery and the lies and deceit. You can't understand the sacrifice of human lives really on a scale unparalleled in all history. The mass loss of life in the First World War and the Second World War, and now, ladies and gentlemen, we are into the Third World War. And you may not want to admit that, but certainly it was just 2 weeks ago yesterday on 60 Minutes 2 when the head of the Israeli Mossad, a man named Halevi, actually said, "We are in World War III." Now, the wars that we've seen, the Afghan war and the Iranian war, Iraqi war, are simply the preludes to this. If you doubt that this was all planned long ahead of time, I suggest you go to the website, not my website, you go to the website, www.newamericancentury.org. Or if you're out there in the listening audience, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'll send you a free copy of our March newsletter, which gives you the background, the real background of the Iraq War. You haven't been told, and you won't be told. But if you go to our website, you'll find a great deal of fascinating information on what Iraq was really all about. So, again, if you'd like a free copy, it's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Go to our website, which is radioliberty.com. That's my website. The other one, www.newamericancentury.org, is their website. It's a small group of people headed by Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, John Boland, and really this small group of people who surround the president today. They created an organization in 1997 called the Project for a New American Century. Read their website, get the information, get my newsletter, and of course we have so much other information. Our latest syllabus entitled Iraq, The Untold Story, Prelude to World War III. We have a syllabus, we have certainly a videotape that goes with that, and it will help you better to understand truly what's going on today. And then help us to get the truth out across America. Pray for our leaders, pray for our country. We ask you to pray for revival in America, because I'm firmly convinced if the American people don't turn back to God, God is going to turn his back on this country. And lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Rosemary, thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
And we'll be back here just tomorrow evening at the same time. Until then, may the Lord be with you.
Gate will open as you go out. You go out and turn right, yes. And just keep going downhill. You can't move. And Barbara will probably have a copy of the tape for you in just a few minutes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But hold your calls for just a few minutes right now, because we have with us on the line one of my favorite guests who keeps us abreast of the events that are taking place, and that's Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief. Joel, thank you so much for being with us.
It's always a pleasure, Stan, to be with you.
Well, now, what's the issue? Now, for our listeners out there who don't know Joel, Joel comes up with a newsletter, an email newsletter every week. He sends it out, and I read it through from beginning to end. And believe me, I have a lot of things to read, but that's one thing I always want to have, because Joel has a real talent for getting the very essence of a story. So let's talk about this week's newsletter, which I haven't had a chance to read because my son hasn't pulled it down yet.
Well, I'm actually going to skip ahead to the one that's coming out tomorrow because I've already written it, and it's most current, especially with this war in Iraq and rapidly moving events. I feel it's important to discuss, you know, things as they're happening.
All right.
I would first, I'd like to discuss, the U.S. suddenly switching gears and backing down on military threats to Syria. But before I go into that, I would like to cover some of the growing anomalies that are coming out of this Iraqi war. You know, U.S. politicians, notably Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, planned really for a cakewalk at first, only putting in a little over 100,000 U.S. troops, and then having to quickly bring in reinforcements when they found initial resistance to be much different than expected. But after only 3 weeks of concerted warfare, mostly massive bombardment, air bombardment rather than actual tank battles, we find it was a relative cakewalk after all. Conquer an entire armed nation with only a couple hundred casualties shows very weak resistance overall. Indeed, anti-war protesters feel like they've been vindicated, Stan, by two general post-war facts. One, that Iraq clearly was no threat to the U.S. in terms of military power, and that two, no major weapons of mass destruction have been found. So, as the war in Iraq is now winding down, the U.S. is obviously declaring victory, although it's a very untidy victory given the level of looting and complete social unrest and lack of preparation for carrying on the policing action that would be necessary in the wake of any war. This is one of the reasons why the military planners wanted to have at least double that many troops so that you could drop off troops in the aftermath of military action to keep order.
Okay.
So there are some still disturbing questions, some unanswered questions emerging from this all too easy and sudden collapse of organized resistance. Number one, why was there no conversion into irregular warfare after the collapse of organized military operations? In other words, if you bombed the death out of a lot of the frontline Iraqi Republican Guard units, they would have normally, as a high elite unit, been prepared to begin irregular harassment units as they retreated back into the city. None of that occurred. Second, why no use of SA-7 Strela missiles against U.S. helicopters? We had some four events where they used them apparently against high-flying jets, which shows they didn't even realize Strelas can't catch jets, that are above 2,000 feet. They're just too slow and don't have the performance. But they are extremely effective against helicopters, and none of them were used against helicopters.
Now, this is what, some is shoulder-to-air or missile?
Right.
Or surface-to-air missile?
These are the Russian equivalent of the Stinger missile, a little less performance than the Stinger. It's the SA-7 Strela. These things should have been hundreds of those things among the units, and yet our helicopters were able to fly at low altitude, low and slow, with relative immunity from many of these. And even our helicopters, with their sophisticated missile capabilities, they have flares that can punch out of the back of helicopters to divert those Strelas, but they still have to see them coming. And if you've got one of them firing one up your tailpipe without a rear-view mirror, which they don't have, these helicopters are very vulnerable. None of that happened. Number three, why were there only one or two effective anti-tank weapons employed against U.S. armor? I mean, they knew the M1 tank was coming. They knew the T-72 Russian tanks were no match. The M1s can outrange this T-72, that is, shoot it from twice the distance away, as computerized firing systems, fire control systems. So literally, when the M1 goes up against the T-72s in open warfare, it's usually a 100-to-1 kill ratio. The Russians had, of course, the Kornet E anti-tank missile, which is capable in one blow of taking out an M1 tank, and there were only one or two used in the Gulf, and we have to ask why. If Russia was the supplier, which it was, of equipment, why didn't they prepare the Iraqis to more effectively deter the U.S. invasion? Number three, why were there no biological or chemical warfare weapons used against the troops if they were going to be going down anyway? What did they have to lose? Number five, where did all the hundreds of thousands of Iraqi soldiers go? And number six, where is Saddam Hussein and all his leadership corps?
Those are the $64,000 questions. And I think every one of those is a very important question. And, of course, there were so many other questions you asked last week. Why didn't they do any of the normal things, you know, to try to impede the advance of the American forces, like mining the roads or blowing up the dams or lighting all the oil wells or blowing up, the airfields so that we couldn't make ready use of them? It would have been very easy to do, but none of the things that were logical were done, to impede America's advance. So suddenly, Donald Rumsfeld looks like, well, he's so much smarter than the military generals. This is the way to fight wars in the future, because Donald Rumsfeld knew something that the military didn't. And obviously he believed that there would be no resistance and none of the things that you've mentioned would be done. How did he know that?
Well, that's right. You see, nobody really would know that unless they had an inside ticket or there were inside deals made with the Russians or the Iraqis. One of the interesting pieces of information that have surfaced in the Internet for many months now have been the CIA connections between Saddam Hussein that go clear back to 1959. You know, the U.S. has admitted that they had tentative relationships with Saddam in the 1980s as it was warring against Iran. But they've never admitted to the public that Saddam Hussein, as a young man in 1959, was recruited by the CIA to be part of the assassination team against Iraqi general who was the prime minister at the time, Qasem. And you know, the attack was somewhat botched, but eventually they got General Ghazim, and Saddam Hussein came into power. And this was all supposedly done in the name of fighting communism, because Ghazim was, in fact, aligned with the communists, and they were worried, apparently, that was the excuse for backing Saddam Hussein in the 1980s because of the overthrow of legitimate government in Iran.
You know, it's very interesting, Joel. There was an article that came out on UPI, I think somewhere the 14th of April, somewhere around in there. But, you know, it's talked about a book called Unholy Babylon. And it quoted the author of that, who is an international correspondent, talking about Saddam's association with the CIA back in the 1950s, the late 1950s and early 1960s. Well, actually, I found a copy of the book, and sure enough, this book, written almost a decade ago, was talking about how Saddam was a part of a group that was funded by the CIA. Now, how many Americans know that the CIA was funding this wicked, wicked, wicked Saddam Hussein? Although we know that we funded him during the 1980s, but of course, most people, we hear about how he used this terrible poison gas, but nobody ever points out that he used a lot of the poison gas against the Iranians during the Iran-Iraq War in 1988, and we continued to back him after that right up until 1990. Why would we back an evil man who was killing his own people, who was torturing people, and who had used poison gas on the Iranians? Why do we only talk about his use of poison gas on the Kuwait, on the Kurds, but we never point out that when he was working with us and we were backing him and financing him, we backed him after and we financed him after he used poison gas? Wouldn't that sort of change the complexion of this this whole war if the American people knew that?
It certainly would, and that's why the deliberate omissions from the establishment media are so very important in controlling public opinion. For example, it's also an interesting anomaly that after the first Gulf War, when they decided to not pursue Saddam Hussein, that they had supposedly achieved their objectives in liberating Kuwait, but they had a chance to destabilize Saddam Hussein both by the Shiite uprising in the south as well as the Kurdish uprising in the north. And in both of those cases, the CIA led those two opposition groups to believe that they would get U.S. support, and the U.S. gave them no support. It was Bay of Pigs all over in both those locations. And so this leads credence to the numerous theories that are popping up that, in fact, Saddam Hussein has been protected by the CIA because he was still some way connected to U.S. covert action. When we dovetail this, Stan, with the problem of Osama bin Laden and the fact that the U.S. has not only never killed or captured Saddam or Osama bin Laden, they have rejected on at least three attempts that I knew of personally of Pakistani informants who have come all the way to the United States to tell where Osama bin Laden is, and they have been rejected at the offices of the Pentagon as not interested. And this the American people doesn't know about. This, of course, dovetails with the rejections of the Clinton administration to take out and take custody of Osama bin Laden. It's in line with the French report that CIA people met with Osama bin Laden in Dubai when he was being given free hospital care at the American hospital in Dubai.
That was about 2 or 3 months before the September 11th attack.
Correct,
wasn't it? Right.
In July, prior to 9/11. So all of this added together makes one very suspicious. There have, in fact, been two or three reports that have come out indicating that that Saddam Hussein was, in fact, given safe haven through secret deals made between the United States and Russia. Conveniently, and I don't even have the resources myself to really verify whether or not these things are true. Sadly, these things that come out of foreign and American intelligence agencies are always suspicious because, one, you have to wonder, as controlled as those agencies are, how is it they're allowed to leak this information and not get caught? They obviously spy on each other. It also cannot be discounted because of these all-too-suspicious inabilities of the U.S. to target and destroy enemy leaders. What makes interesting about these stories, and one of which, if I can give some references, one is in GulfNews.com. Another one, a site is at fpp.co.uk, and another is tehrantimes.com. Each of these three sites tell the story of various deals that were made, and two of these come out of Iranian sources, and one of them comes out of an American source, given to an Arab source, retranslated back into American, and that one is particularly suspicious. And even the author of the website says, you've got to be careful. This sounds like there may be some disinformation.
Well, what is it basically saying, though?
But basically, they're saying that the United States cut a deal with Russia to take Saddam and his top leadership into safe hiding in exchange for giving Russia $5 billion as part of its partial payment against the $8 billion debt that Iraq owed to Russia, and that the bombing of the restaurant in the middle of Baghdad was in fact a cover story to give a rational excuse for Saddam Hussein and his top 50 leaders for having disappeared.
In other words, we want to convince the American people we really tried to get him, whereas the truth of the matter is we were complicit in his escape. Is that what you're suggesting?
That's what the stories claim. And as I say, I cannot, I don't have the capability of verifying these things. These are really deep, dark, undercover type secrets. But one thing did seem to me very strange about this bombing of the restaurant, and that is that Saddam Hussein, knowing that they had this capability, knowing that they had bombers circling overhead that could target within minutes, and that they had agents circulating looking for him, that he would take the risk of going with all of his people to a single restaurant where it could not be failed to be observed by other people. This just is very, very unlike a person who keeps five or six doubles circulating around. We certainly didn't know, and neither would a source be able to tell if it were a double showing up at the restaurant or Saddam Hussein himself, and doubtful as well that he would be walking out in the open sufficient to be recognized. So all of those things made that very, very suspicious. Nevertheless, these are stories I can't prove, but the mere fact that we have another dangling enemy leader still out there in the wanted list, as well as Osama bin Laden in the U.S. with all of its intelligence capability. I mean, it's like 9/11, as you pointed out correctly before, Stan, that all of a sudden, 24 hours later, they have all this intelligence about all the hijackers, and yet they seemingly knew nothing that could have prevented this. And the same thing happens here in Iraq. All of a sudden, they go into the Ministry of Intelligence, which was a bombed-out building, and they come out with reams of intelligence, supposedly in Arabic and Russian, and it's all translated. And when you look at that intelligence, it would have taken analysts 2 weeks to decipher and translate and get this all organized, and yet this was all presented to the news media in 24 hours. Normally this stuff, by the way, is kept top secret. So why was it released? And it seems like this has the ring of disinformation, in the sense that this information, although probably true, because we know that Russia had tremendous relationships with Iraq, nevertheless, it probably came from other sources, not from this building, and the U.S. was using the cover story of having discovered it in the intelligence building rather than reveal that they had this by eavesdropping and other means.
Well, are you acquainted with Robert Baer's book, See No Evil, where Robert Baer, formerly the chief CIA agent in northern Iraq in 1995, stated he did not know one Iraqi who didn't believe that the United States government was keeping Saddam in power, and some of them even believed that he was at that time on the CIA payroll. Now, that's an amazing statement from somebody in the CIA. And, of course, then in my letter, of course, I simply quote all the reasons why the Iraqi people believe that, and even though Robert Baer, the author of the book, sort of poo-poos the idea, maybe he wants to have a long and prosperous life. But, of course, in the end, you come to the same conclusion that there's a very good reason why the Iraqi people believe that, because the American government was doing everything they could to help him, letting him smuggle oil to adjacent countries and to Jordan and Turkey. All we had to do was say, stop that, do not allow him to bring oil into your country. They would have had to, there certainly were attempts by the Iraqi military to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And, of course, our government. Each instance had betrayed the Iraqi military, almost like we were trying to keep them in power, almost as if this whole thing were being laid out for a time, just as we've seen in this last few weeks, this beginning of this third world war that we seem to be undertaking. So what do you think is going to happen as far as Syria is concerned? We initially were hearing, you know, that Syria has chemical and biological weapons, and some of Saddam's family is over there enjoying themselves in luxury, and the inference almost initially was why Syria is going to be next on the line. And then suddenly they seem to be backing away from that a little bit.
Yes, they are, Stan, and this deserves some interesting analysis. First of all, in answer to the question which relates to Syria about why the Iraqis didn't use biological or chemical weapons on the U.S., in the first place, the U.S. knows by satellite photos that these biological and chemical weapons went to Syria in large convoys that were guarded by military troops. They had those on satellite photos and reconnaissance overflights in October and November. Even while inspectors were there, the U.S. refused to intervene in those convoys, which they had a right to. They could have put inspectors on the ground and stopped the convoys. They did not. So they know that they're in Syria, and Israeli intelligence that has a lot of men on the ground in Syria have confirmed as well that they're there. I've also accessed in tomorrow's World Affairs Brief what the actual intelligence digest from U.S. intelligence says about biological and chemical weapons in Syria. So I happen to know that the U.S. knows that Syria has these weapons, and yet all of a sudden they're, of course, putting out little tidbits of tantalizing information, which and not the big stuff. It looks as if they're covering for Syria now, as they have been covering before. And even though I had predicted that it was in the globalist interest of the U.S. to take on Syria afterwards, I had also said that they probably wanted to let the Iraqi war settle down for at least 6 months to a year, so that it wouldn't appear to be another rash warmongering move. I suspect, frankly, that if the U.S. kind of tested the waters and felt very strongly that if they went after Syria right now, even as Iraq hadn't even settled down, that the U.S. public opinion would turn dramatically negative about supporting this constant warfare. In fact, it would have fed the anti-war movement tremendously if they had seen this warmongering. So I think the U.S. has been very astute and savvy in perceiving that they'd better slow down this warmongering junket. But I don't believe for a minute that they really have ceased their designs to continue to antagonize the Arab and the Muslim world. I think they're going to continue to do so. But they're simply going to wait till there's another provocation, until Iraq has settled down where they have a definitive success. They certainly are overextended there and could not handle the potential barrage of missiles that Syria could throw out at U.S. troops, even though the conventional military of Syria is even in worse shape than the Iraqi conventional military was before this war.
Well, you know, I think that's really so fascinating, because I think I mentioned to you that I'd actually had the opportunity to interview Dor Gold, who was the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations under Netanyahu's government, and certainly well-versed in what is known by Iraqi intelligence, pardon me, by Israeli intelligence. And what I simply off the cuff commented, well, I understand, of course, that Saddam Hussein had sent his chemical and biological weapons into Syria. We had satellite pictures of the convoys, and of course, you know, I don't believe that there are any weapons in Iraq today. He picked up right up on that and said, oh, yes, we know that they moved the weapons into Syria. So this confirms certainly what you said, that our government, the Israeli government, everybody knew that there no, the chemical and biological weapons had been moved on into Syria. Everybody knew, but the American people, who we had to convince them, oh, they're terrible chemical and biological weapons, and look, we found all these Iraqis soldiers, and they've got gas masks. Look, here are pictures of them. Well, the question I had as I looked at those pictures of the Iraqi gas masks is, How do we know that they weren't just salting these pictures? In other words, trying to create the impression in the American people's minds that the Iraqis had the chemical and biological weapons and we were going to use them, and that's why we had to keep advancing, because, of course, the chemical and biological weapons were there. Whereas they'd been moved out of Iraq a long time before, and our government knew that, but they couldn't let the American people know that. How could they possibly admit to the American people that the war was fought for entirely different reasons than the men who were sent there to fight and die were ever told?
It is very clear that the U.S. has made specific attempts to embed within the troops not only the reporters, but specific military people trained to go in and hunt out not only weapons of mass destruction, but seek out these individuals who they have captured, you know, Iraqi leaders, etc. They desperately want some bad people to present as victory trophies for all of this effort going into the war. And many of these things end up being suspicious, as I talked about, the very suspicious excess material that they apparently found in a bombed-out intelligence building. Finding it all too soon from someone such as myself who knows how laborious it is to go through and sort through rubble and come out with definitive reports and translate them in out of foreign languages and then leak them to the press in 24 hours. That's very suspicious. It was also very suspicious when they went in and overran the nuclear weapons facility, which is an open facility, has been under inspection ever since 1993. And suddenly, the Marines, within hours, find these huge underground chambers that apparently inspectors there for 10 years have never been able to find, claiming, of course, that their meters were going off the wall with radiation. Well, if they were going off the wall, they wouldn't be standing around looking at their meters. They would be very, very ill within a very few minutes. There are no protective suits that protect against radiation. So it made me very, very suspicious about them standing around opening barrels that were making their meters go off the wall. I don't know what the truth is about that, but I know that there is some exaggeration and some findings there that the U.S. is using.
Now, one of the stories we have heard, and I want to get your thought on this, is that one reason that there was not a more effective Iraqi defense was that many of the generals have been contacted, many of the Iraqi generals have been contracted and told, well, you throw in the towel and we won't prosecute you. If you oppose us, why, we'll try you for war crimes. And, of course, supposedly there were a lot of places within our intelligence unit that were in cell phone contact with the Iraqi generals. Have you heard anything about that?
Yes. In fact, this is part of the reports from the Tehran Times that I mentioned before. And there were also reports from Debka.com about a negotiating team that the U.S. had flown into Jordan and that was in negotiation. And the Tehran Times article leaked out of Iran talks about the fact that our negotiating teams made a deal with Iraqi guard generals and in fact, took over the Baghdad airport first so that they could, in fact, fly out the top two echelons of Iraqi Guard generals and higher-ranking officers as part of this deal to save the higher-ranking people. Now, we may be able to find confirmation later on of whether or not these types of things are true by looking at what kind of manhunt they do with the puppet regime that the U.S. establishes in Iraq. If they go out and, as they should, if these people had melded into the population and were still considered enemies, we should see that, in fact, the Iraqis' puppet regime will go through and do house-to-house searches and arrest all of these people, and we should see them come out. If they never are arrested and they have, in fact, disappeared, then it's very difficult for me to believe that they could have done so while being completely surrounded by U.S. troops. There were no highways out of Baghdad to Iran, to Syria, to Jordan, to anywhere that they could have gotten through with the kind of surveillance, tracking people at night, and special helicopter teams that the U.S. has poised at all the border areas to intercept and check through caravans. They even shot up the Russian ambassador's entourage leaving in their limousines to Syria. So I find it very difficult to believe that these people are going to escape unless some deal has been made.
Now, there was an interesting article I read that supposedly just a couple of days before the fall of Baghdad, and this is the story that's told, that Saddam appeared on the streets of Baghdad, and he gave a speech to a cheering throng saying, "I'm here to fight with you. You know, we will never give up." And then he gets in his limousine and a whole entourage of limousines and drives off. And, you know, 24 hours later, why, the American troops are there, and 48 hours later, Baghdad has fallen. And people saying, well, obviously he wasn't, he was making a fast getaway, but where would he make a getaway to is the question. And I think that's the question that you ask very, very pointedly, that certainly there's no way he could have gotten away without help from the American government.
Well, certainly I don't think it would be healthy for him to go into Syria or Iran, into one of the Russian southern Muslim states would be a safe bet, where the U.S. wouldn't be looking there. Of course, if the U.S. were part of the deal, you know, obviously they're not going to be looking very hard anywhere at all. Although it's very interesting to understand that even when you're dealing with Osama bin Laden...
I'm going to have to interrupt you there. We'll be right back in just a moment here on Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Joel Skousen, and of course, he is the publisher of A World Affairs Brief. And before we go on, and we've got Mike calling in from Santa Cruz, Joel, I want you to get your telephone number and your website out so people will know how to get copies of World Affairs Brief.
Well, thank you, Stan. The World Affairs Brief is a weekly news analysis service that I put out. It comes in two versions. The preferred versions is the email version, because it comes out every week. The printed edition is also weekly and has most of the material of the email edition, but it doesn't get printed and typeset till the end of the month. Now, you can check out about the World Affairs Brief on my website, www.joelskousen.com. That's spelled JoelSkousen, as one word, joelskousen.com. And if you don't have access to the Internet, you can call my office when I'm not on an interview like this at area code 801-224-4746. And if you want a sample copy of tomorrow's brief, I'll be happy to send that out to you, which will cover most of the things that we're discussing this evening.
All right, fine. And Joel does a tremendous job of really keeping us abreast of what's going on. Well, let's go to Mike in Santa Cruz, and let me remind you, if you're out across America, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Mike, did you have a question or comment?
A question or both. regarding escape routes, what about tunnels?
Well,
that's certainly an idea to get into other cities. It has been very, I don't know of any city within range of tunneling depth. There's, many, many tens of miles to the nearest border. I feel like tunnels would be very difficult to do that. By the way, the U.S. has ground-penetrating radar that can detect tunnels as well, although that's irrelevant if the U.S. is cutting a deal with Saddam Hussein and letting him get out of town.
I think, Mike, what I've heard is that there was a lot of tunnels under Baghdad. They were going to put in a subway, and then they never did, but they put in a lot of tunnels in the process. But, you know, you're still just going to be running around Baghdad. They're not going to get you to Syria or into one of the other adjacent countries. So I don't think that's how he escaped. I think if he escaped, somebody was going to be helping him.
I tend to think he may well have gotten out that way. Granted, we can detect tunnels if we want to.
Yeah, but where are the tunnels are taking him to?
Anywhere.
Well, where are they going to take him?
Anywhere.
Anywhere. You mean they got tunnels that go all the way into Syria from Baghdad?
And beyond.
All right. Well,
given the types of tunnel making technology going on these days.
All right, fine. But do you have any evidence of it?
But that's very detectable by the amount of dirt that has to come out of a tunnel going 300 kilometers.
No.
You're going to have a mountain on one side
or
the other.
They don't necessarily need to bring all that dirt out. They recycle the dirt into a very hard, compact, and strong wall for the tunnel itself. Anybody can surf the net and see all sorts of exotic tunnel-making equipment that's been used for the last couple decades. And I wanted to ask Joel, are you familiar with Cutting Edge Ministries and their newsletter? No?
I'm not.
And they give an interesting perspective on a number of things, but in the most recent newsletter, this possibility of tunnels is brought up. I really think that we operate in collusion with Saddam, and we would have very easily let him escape. And I mean, when I say we, I mean the upper echelons of our own traitorous government. And they would give him a pat on the back and tell him, job well done. And now we don't need you there anymore. And so you can go inhabit your favorite tropical island wherever you want.
You mean Timothy McVeigh, Osama bin Laden, and Saddam Hussein all there drinking martinis?
I don't know about McVeigh.
All right.
I heard somebody with an interesting argument to say he's still alive and that execution didn't go the way they said it did.
Okay, anything else, Mike?
Okay, that's all. Thanks.
Thanks so much. All right. Well, I said that, of course, with tongue in cheek. But anyway, it is very, very strange. We've just never been able to catch Osama bin Laden. And as Joel has said on several occasions, and I have other information that backs it up, we've had repeated attacks to catch Osama bin Laden since 9/11. And, of course, we've never done it. Could that be because, of course, the bin Laden family is so close to the Bush family? It seems very, and it's so, remember the young man named Hinckley who shot and tried to kill President Reagan. Who was he? He was the son of one of George Herbert Walker Bush's closest friends. Maybe just another coincidence.
Anyway, what was not a coincidence about Hinckley, though, was that he had disappeared from public view for the 2 years before this assassination. And his only surfacing during that 2 years was to establish credentials with a psychiatrist for mental problems.
Right.
And that's very suspicious. That has the telltale markings of someone who goes into dark side operations for the CIA.
It's sort of like Timothy McVeigh. I do know that there was a psychiatrist. His name was Jocelyn West. CIA, very well-known, very famous CIA psychiatrist who made recurrent visits to the jail to visit Timothy McVeigh. And why would a CIA psychiatrist be visiting Timothy McVeigh? It's a question that nobody wants to ask. Had you heard that at all?
I had not heard that, Stan.
Actually, I got that from three different sources, and they all seem to have similar slants on the same story. In fact, one of them said that the jailers had told them that Timothy McVeigh didn't want to see Jolly West, but he was, of course, sent in anyway. But actually, Timothy McVeigh had a contact with him previously when he was working on some sort of a top security. He was a guard in a top security CIA facility. Well, anyway, that's a long way from what's going on. What are some of the other things you wanted to cover?
Let me talk about the setbacks the U.S. is occurring as it tries to build up its puppet regime in Iraq.
Okay.
And I use the word puppet regime purposely. I'm being derisive because that's exactly what they're trying to do. It's just like Afghanistan. Hamid Karzai is an ex-oil executive doing the bidding of the New World Order in that country, and Afghanistan is quickly deteriorating back into tribal warfare in the parts that the U.S. does not have control of, and I suspect much of that same thing will happen in Iraq.
Well, was Karzai living in America, or had he lived in America for a time?
Well, mostly England and yes, some time in America as well.
Okay, fine. So, but he, I know he'd been a consultant for UNICAL, and
that's
it was
correct.
Interesting that UNICAL were the ones who wanted to put the oil line across Afghanistan, and Nayak Nawaz, who was the Pakistani foreign minister, had commented that in July of 91, he'd been heard the officials saying that, you know, we'll either pave their streets with gold or we'll pave them with carpet bombs, talking about Afghanistan. So anyway, that is in a book called Forbidden Knowledge. It's a book we do carry through Radio Liberty. Forbidden Knowledge, written by a couple of French authors, gives you tremendous insight into which you'll never read in the New York Times. So anyway, let's get into the puppet regime as you see it unfolding there. And certainly, it was very, very interesting this last weekend. There was a meeting, apparently, there had been an Iraqi Ayatollah, probably one of the leaders of the Shiites, who'd been living for some time, in, I believe, in London. And the United States sent him back with $3 million and a telephone and told him to get together all the religious leaders and you know, maybe they could help to form the new government. And of course, the Iraqi leader, the Muslim leader, got together 25 people, and they were in a mosque. And suddenly, a crowd appears. And they're shouting, one of the people who worked for Saddam, and the crowd charges the religious leaders. Now, that doesn't sound like good Muslims, charging the religious leaders. And it, of course, all of the religious leaders have these telephones that have been given to them by the United States officials. I assume it was CIA. And all they had to do was press the button, and the troops would immediately arrive to protect them. The only trouble is they kept pressing the buttons, and no American troops come, and this religious leader, one of the most prominent Muslim clerics, is killed, along with a couple of other people there, and the rest of them are, some of them are badly beaten. And Chris, the question is, did this happen by accident? What's so interesting is the story I just told you came out of the San Jose Mercury. In the New York Times, it's the same story, but they never mentioned that the people had been promised they'd be protected, that they were all given telephones, and when they pressed the button on the telephone to bring the troops, why no troops came. So it's interesting how the New York Times alters the story so that it would appear just to be a terrible tragedy. But as you read the article in the San Jose Mercury, which obviously they had some people over there, you almost had a feeling that, was this another example of betrayal? Because the last thing that we want is a Muslim or a religious government over there.
Well, there's more to that story than I have in tomorrow's brief, Stan.
All right, fine. Well, let's find out about it then.
One of the other people who was killed in that mob action was Nizar Khosrowshahi. Now, for those of your listeners who don't know who Khosrowshahi is, he was the highest-ranking Iraqi general that had ever defected to the West. He was kept in protective custody in Denmark, where he had received asylum for many years. And as I pointed out in my World Affairs brief, some 3 weeks ago, he happened to disappear out of Denmark. And one source in Denmark said that they had suspected the CIA had spirited him away, or that the Iraqi intelligence had finally hunted him down and killed him. Well, I said in my World Affairs brief 3 weeks ago, I said, I'm going to watch to see if Khosrowshahi shows up in Iraq, because that will mean, in fact, that the CIA had spirited him away. Seymour Hersh from the New York Times did let it slip, as well as London-based Arab News said that CIA sources had said basically that Khosrowshahi was their chosen leader to form the new government in Iraq after Saddam. Now, this is a major setback then. Only one news source, albawaba.com, has reported that it was Khosrowshahi that was dead, as the other prominent leader that was meeting with these clerics there. He could only have gotten in there, of course, had he been rescued out of Denmark or spirited away and flown there by CIA sources. And others have confirmed that he was in seen in Qatar at U.S. headquarters there prior to getting into Iraq. So this is a major setback and may indicate that, in fact, things got out of hand for the CIA. And it may well have been Khosrowshahi's presence there as one of the former Iraqi generals who was in charge of the gas attacks against the Iranians and the Kurds, that that his presence had incited this particular riot.
But you would think that if they were going to have all these people and they really wanted them to lead the government, they would have had some guards there for them. I understand that there were guards, say, for the Iraqi oil building, but no American guards for the museum. And what was even more surprising, no American guards for these people, you know, these religious leaders who could bring the end of the strife over there, because most of the people, being Muslim, would follow the clerics, the the Islamic leaders.
Although we have to remember that this, of course, was the day before the meeting in Nasiriyah, where it was highly publicized on American television, where all of the supposed opposition leaders were meeting for an initial powwow with U.S. sources. Conspicuously absent, however, were the Shiite leaders from that very area where this riot had occurred. They were boycotting the meeting because they were underrepresented. And this is symptomatic of everything that happens in the Arab world when you try to get them together, because they don't want to have equal representation. They want to have basically hegemony based upon how many people they have, and the Shiite minority is a very large minority.
I thought that they had almost 60% of the people.
I'm sorry, you're right. It's the Sunnis that are the minority.
Right.
They've been ruling, and it's the Shiites that are the majority. They were obviously underrepresented and boycotted the meeting. Meanwhile, Ahmed Chalabi finally motors into Iraq, accompanied by a couple of hundred free Iraqi forces. These are U.S.-trained opposition forces from the Iraqi National Congress. Chalabi is the very disreputable leader of that London-based organization. It's an organization fraught with infighting itself. They only put together a show of unity because the CIA threatened them that they wouldn't allow them back into Iraq unless they became unified. So they're now presently factionalizing as fast as they can now that they're in Iraq, and Chalabi, of course, has brought along an armed force and as well as many pickup trucks loaded with food to help buy his way into the hearts and minds of the Baghdad residents.
Well, now, wasn't he the fellow who was over in Iran and probably over in Jordan and involved in all sorts of hanky-panky and dishonest dealings over there? And
That's right. He was in charge of the Petrobank, which built many millions of dollars from Shia exiles there in Jordan, and so he's got a 22-year-odd sentence on his head over there, and the U.S., of course, will twist Jordan's arm to make sure that that sentence is commuted if Chalabi, gets a major position. But, there's a lot of potential infighting here, even perhaps between Chalabi and Khazraji that allowed someone to spark that riot. It may not have been U.S. dealing whatsoever if U.S. Was backing Khazraji and he ended up getting killed in that. This may well have gotten away from them or been representative of some of this factional fighting between these groups. But it doesn't bode well for the U.S. being able to put down or to establish a so-called democratic regime with any amount of peace anytime soon.
Well, now, I'd heard that, and I can't remember whether the State Department wanted or didn't want Chalabi, but certainly they wanted one candidate, and the Pentagon wanted
another.
It was
the Pentagon that wanted Khazraji.
Okay. They wanted Khazraji, and it was the State Department that wanted Chalabi?
Chalabi, right.
Chalabi, okay,
yes.
Fine. So, here you have, even within our own government, we can't decide who's going to be the token leader there, who's going to carry out a directive. So, this is sort of a sad situation. And what is really the most disturbing at all, they send the military in, but they've got no military police. They've got nobody to restore law and order. The looting that occurred, the destruction of the museum, the destruction of, some sacred sites. I mean, certainly terrible things are going to happen in war. But, you have to be prepared to reestablish order as soon as you get, as soon as the shooting stops. And you would think that they would have thought of that ahead of time. But, of course, instead of that, you just have this chaos. And there's going to be a lot of bitterness on the part of the Iraqi people against the United States. Not necessarily that they wanted Saddam Hussein. I think a lot of them hated him and wanted to get rid of him because he was a ruthless tyrant. But, what we've done is destroyed the value of their money. A lot of the shopkeepers have, had their shops looted. They had no way to protect them. And, of course, a lot of the middle class has been simply wiped out in the war. Wars are terrible things because they destroy a lifetime of work and effort.
There may be reason in this madness, not good reason to be sure, but, out of chaos, as in most Hegelian things, which our government is very expert in, we find a ready excuse to be able to bringing emergency procedures. For example, we find that in the destruction of Iraqi currency, guess what the U.S. is shipping in plane loads now? U.S. dollar in currency. So they're apparently going to put Iraq supposedly temporarily on a dollar basis, and it may well just stay that way. Another dollarization country to increase use of the dollar. But in any case, the allowing of rioting to go forth has given them an excuse to immediately give a big fat contract to DynCorp to come in and provide law enforcement services. I don't think anybody in Congress would have bought into having DynCorp with its sullied reputation. You know, it was the one found guilty of running sex slaves in Bosnia as part of its U.S. government contract. And DynCorp will now be running the police training in the country and managing all this so-called return to law enforcement. DynCorp is a CIA proprietary organization masquerading as an independent company. It does black ops with former military people, as well as the other clone of DynCorp, MPRI Associates, which is another ex-military, mercenary, U.S. government contractee. Bechtel, the big giant in utilities and construction, has been given all of the reconstruction contracts to put all the utilities back in force. And Halliburton, as you know, Cheney's old company, has been given the oil contracts. What's interesting about all of this, Stan, is that these very, very ample million and sometimes billion-dollar contracts were signed without any of these countries having access to be able to assess the bids for this reconstruction work. In other words, the destruction had not even been finished by the time they were awarded these reconstruction contracts.
And, of course, what about the bidding on them? And were they bidding on them, or were they simply they passing out the lollipops to your friendly children?
You see, that's exactly the point, is that what this indicates is that these huge amounts have either extra padding in them to adjust for what couldn't have been bid on, or that they're essentially open-ended without an actual fixed payment, and the fixed payment is simply what they told the media, but the contract actually says we pay you whatever you want to finish the job. All of this adds legitimate fuel to the charges that the left has been making about collusion government with insider-controlled corporations. It makes their charges about greedy capitalism look all too valid.
Well, of course, I think then we can explain the war that it was simply for profit, and that's exactly what the Marxists and the leftists want to be able to say, and I think it is far more complicated than that. You know, one of the interesting things is that, of course, we're talking about we want to get the police back on the job. Well, these are the same police who worked for Saddam Hussein. We want to get the bureaucrats back on the job. These are the same bureaucrats who worked for Saddam Hussein. Now, I'm not suggesting that, perhaps some of these people were simply there as a job. But, of course, they were working for a totally ruthless regime. And, of course, you know, when the dust settles, we see a lot of the same people doing exactly the same thing within the bureaucracy. I think a lot of Arabs are going to say, what have we really accomplished? We may have got Saddam. Now we have another token leader who is subservient to the Americans. And, of course, we have exactly the same people running the government as we had before. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, they had to do the same thing in Germany, and they hired a lot of the Nazi administrators to come back in. And granted, a lot of those people were Nazis only because they had their arms twisted or they wouldn't have kept their jobs had they not joined the party, and much of that probably occurred in Iraq as well. I think there's no choice but to initially go back to people who were in the job because you simply can't train new people, to do what they did. But I think a good administration would require that you go in and do investigations on everyone, and anyone who was ruthless or in charge or charged with legitimate crimes or abuse of power needs to be replaced.
Well, there are so many stories about, of course, after the Second World War with the wicked, wicked Nazis, and yet the OSS helped many of them escape to South America, brought 1,000 Nazi scientists to America, even brought over the head of the German Gestapo, Heinrich Mueller, and gave him a plush job.
What was particularly galling about that, Stan, was that it was those same people who were allowing the cream of the real evil Nazis to escape judgment that were pointing the finger and decrying hiring, where Patton in his district in Bavaria were hiring Nazis to take over the administration. They crucified Patton over that issue, when those people were relatively innocent of any of the crimes of Nazism. But the real criminals were protected by the U.S. government.
And, of course, I think that is a pretty good indication that, of course, there is behind everything going on sort of a brotherhood of a cultist. And, of course, they always seem to help one another. They seem to know who they are. And although some people are held and punished for crimes that they may or may not have been guilty of, sometimes the most guilty are the ones who get away and are rewarded with fat jobs right here in the United States after the war. And I think that's what's so unconscionable about what's going on. Well, our telephone number, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest, is Joel Skousen, and we are talking about his World Affairs Brief. And, of course, you can get that by, what's the telephone number again?
801-224-4746.
All right, that's 801-224-4746, and you can call, and you'll get a free copy of it, and hopefully some of you will feel that it's worthwhile having, and we don't get anything for it. We just think that it's a very important source of information. I always look forward to it because Joel raises some of the questions that nobody else is raising, and that is, why was it so easy? Why was all the military wrong and Donald Rumsfeld was right as far as the course of the war? Either he's a lot smarter than all the military, or he knew things that the military did not. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely, Stan.
All right, is there anything else that we should be talking about?
Yeah, there's something very strange about this $80 billion funding that went in. The total on the war right now is supposedly up to $20 billion, but Bush was given, at least he wanted, discretionary control out of $60 billion of the $63 that was allocated to the military. That leaves a slush fund left over of almost $17 billion. And sure enough, tucked in with this funding bill for the war was lots of pork barrel projects to get everybody's signature on the line. There was $2.5 billion earmarked for rebuilding Iraq, which won't even come close. I'm sure there's some black budget fundings that desperately need funding. The State Department wanted to control these funds as well. In the end, Congress let both of them get their hand in this $60 million pot because, obviously, it's not all going to the military. Almost $20 billion that was related to pork barrel items, $98 million to complete an agricultural research center at Ames, Iowa, $50 million in shipbuilding subsidies. Now, what has that got to do with the war in Iraq? $3 million to repair a Vermont dam, and a provision to designate Alaska wild salmon as organic. All that was tucked into the bill. There were more millions for homeland security, naturally, and another $3 billion bailout for the airlines. There was also an $8 billion bailout for Turkey, even though Turkey had rejected U.S. bribery attempts earlier and refused entrance to our troops. So obviously there was another secret deal cut with Turkey that the American public was not told about.
Well, you know, of course, Turkey is a pivotal country over there, and apparently in the last few years it's becoming increasingly Islamic. Of course, in the past they've had a secular government in that Muslim nation going back to Ataturk. But recently, of course, the radical Islamists are gaining power, and I think this is the only way that you can bribe them to keep them from that country going totally in the radical Islamic camp. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, certainly, you know, there is a lot of hostility towards America and Turkey, and they literally had to buy their way into the situation. It still isn't helping. Turkey is very, very adamant that they don't want the Kurds to have an independent state. The Kurds deserve to have an independent nation. Iraq should not be containing or governing the Shiite portions or the Kurdish portions. It certainly does increase tensions. It's like Bosnia and Kosovo all over again, especially with raw democracy. You simply cannot have justice when you give all power to those that have the majority position. You can only have true justice when you have a constitutional system with limited powers on majority rule, as we have in the United States, so that minority rights are strongly protected by a constitution, and the majority does not have all power.
And, of course, then you would have separate states. You'd have Kurdistan, you'd have the Syrian Christians, you'd have the Shiites, you'd have the Sunni Muslims, and then a very weak central government to carry out affairs between them. But otherwise, when you're going to have a Shiite, governing, if it's certainly a majority rule, they have 60% of the people over there. So we're simply going to have another authoritarian system. Joel, thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure.
My pleasure, Stan. Thank
you. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Just reminding you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We'd love to hear from you if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter. 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV. War.
Shed his grace on me.
Hi, Sri. Well, ruin that.